Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Thank you for joining us for today's Pediatric Insight. I'm Craig Hellemeyer. Council members joining us today are Daniel LaRocca-Arena, Bruder Stapleton, Bruce Rubin, Bob Sawin, John Hayes, and our special guest today is Jamie Diamonds, Executive Associate Dean for Finance and Administration at Indiana University School of Medicine. The topic that we'll be discussing is academic funds flow and faculty compensation.
I think we'll have Jamie start us off with some of the basics of the components of institutional fund flow.
Thanks, Craig. I've got a couple of slides here that I'll pull up that may help illustrate the points. When I think about or talk about funds flow, I think about it as investments made and resources that get allocated to support the various missions. So you can almost think of it like a sources and uses. Where are the funds coming in from and how are they being deployed? You know, you see here in yellow funds that typically would come from either the university or the state, if you're a state that gets an appropriation for higher education. You can see a big chunk of funds that come in from clinical revenue and either hospital or health system partners here in green. And then you've got kind of external partnership funds, either the NIH or other grant or contractual funds, donors, gifts and endowments. Most schools or departments generate a small portion of revenue from auxiliary sales or services they provide. Most medical schools, and this is true for IU, the bulk of those funds are deployed in compensation, salary and benefits. And then if you add in general expenses and some typical capital and equipment and things, you know, that's almost 90% of a school's budget. Another way to think about funds flow is, you know, a pie chart like this, and this is a breakdown here at Indiana of our $2.6 billion operating revenue. You can see between the green slice of the pie and the yellow slice of the pie, which is the clinical revenues that come in from health system, makes almost 70% of our operating budget. We've got a little bit, almost 20% comes from grants, and then the rest in terms of parent support and tuition and some other things. I think it's important for leaders to get down or drill down maybe even a level below that and really understand the details on what makes up some of those flows. You've got flows from the health system here over to the school. You've got funds that go from the health system directly to academic departments, and obviously funds flow from the dean's office to those departments. And then you've got funds that flow from the health system to the group practice, if that is a separate entity. And I refer to this slide as kind of the spaghetti diagram because you've got arrows going everywhere. It's a complicated mix, but a really important mix.
That was really very helpful. I was wondering, Jamie, if you might be willing to make some statements about faculty compensation in general. I know you've had a lot of experience with that, you know, during your career. And are there some guidelines that we should really think about as we begin to approach the issue of how we evaluate and implement faculty compensation plans?
As we think about faculty comp here in the dean's office, you know, we view our role at a high level in terms of providing kind of guidelines and principles around how we want to pay our physicians and what we think constitutes fair market value, if you will. So most organizations utilize some sort of benchmarks, whether that's the AAMC or the Sullivan-Cotter LCG benchmarks, MGMA incorporates some private practice statistics into their benchmarks. This group is all familiar with the AAAP for pediatric subspecialties. And then factoring in kind of regional or market considerations. Here in Indiana, it's pretty difficult to recruit faculty, especially those that are being pursued by organizations on the coast. And so there's a bit of a premium that we pay for physician services here in the state. Many organizations have to factor in kind of strategic things like, do they want to pay their primary care docs a bit higher to incent some of the referral behaviors, or do they look at underserved areas of the state and pay a premium to get physicians to practice in rural areas? So lots of things to think about.
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. I think those are really important observations. I'd be interested, as one talks about faculty compensation, and certainly you look at guidelines and benchmarks, whether other organizations have paid types of physicians, and you really gave us some really good examples on how that might vary. I guess I'd be really interested to hear from perhaps yourself or others on how determination of faculty effort has played an issue in terms of evaluating those levels of compensation and some of the pitfalls that people have come across as they look at determining faculty effort.
I'll make a couple quick comments and then I'll defer to John and Craig. It gets a little tricky, right? When you're thinking about faculty effort distribution and how you compensate for some of those different roles. One challenge is thinking about protected effort or faculty who have administrative roles, medical directorships, things like that. Often you find yourself trying to understand whether or not you pay clinical rates for those roles or you pay something else, given that it's really a different kind of function. Balancing that with making sure you don't disincentivize somebody for wanting to operate in one of those roles. And then obviously with the grants, you've always got the cost share component to keep in mind with NIH and other grants.
Yeah, I know as a chair or even as a dean, it's oftentimes very difficult to figure out how to bring about equity in compensation if people have different types of effort. You might have a star researcher who has two R01s that bring in 60, 70% of their salary and a relatively small amount for clinical effort. So how does one bring about equity in terms of that salary versus a clinician who's 80% clinical, and that sometimes becomes very difficult.
We went through a pretty extensive process of determining RVUs and effort, and looking at the NICU and the PICU is so different than if you look at primary care and faculty practice. And the issue of equity was really an important one, and we went quite deep. We had a consultant, Bruce Vladek. I don't know if you're familiar with Bruce's work. He had been former HCFA, now CMS folks. So we went through this extensive process that was led by the division directors and really engaged the faculty. Now, I've forgotten, to be honest, I've forgotten all of the details, but it was at this attempt to understand why primary care is so undervalued and how you could compensate for that. And I'd love to hear some of the things that perhaps you have in your experience of actually compensating for that inequity, because it's very hard. If you have cardiovascular surgeons or you have, cognitive work versus procedural compensation, it's really devil in the details. Do you have some thoughts about sort of lessons learned about that?
I think, in my experience, it's very important to actually get down into the weeds in terms of
Yeah.
understanding when one looks at determination of faculty effort, what goes into defining faculty effort and those RVUs or other work product that's actually produced. Interns, residents, are they included in the faculty effort? If they're overseeing a clinic that has a large number of residents or interns that are overseeing, other health professionals, such as physician assistants and nurse practitioners, are their RVUs included in a particular faculty? And oftentimes, those type of small type of things which you don't think make a difference really do make a difference in terms of assessing primary care potential. Unfortunately, and Jamie, I don't know if you've had experience with this, many of the reporting systems that we use nationwide to determine faculty effort, that there's a lot of looseness in terms of how people report that data, and it sometimes is difficult to get into that level, but lets one make that determination.
One other point is there have been studies looking at gender equity and really the analysis. Kathy DeAngelis years ago went through this when she was presented data, and she said, well, the data aren't correct. Let's go deep to understand the issues of compensation and gender equity. So I'd love sort of your experience in that. And I think it's a tough nut to crack sometimes.
I think it really is. A lot of it has to do with some of the ways that work products are actually evaluated do have some biases in them. And some of them are gender, some of them are whatever, practice site, whatever. And those biases tend to be covered up and then carried to the top and used to determine effort allocation. And that can be a very difficult thing.
The salary compensation is one of the biggest challenges for leaders because of, the differential market competition for someone, say, that's an interventional cardiologist or, interestingly, a pediatric dermatologist versus a primary care. When I started out in my career as a chair, I sort of didn't understand that you don't base a salary on what's fair in your own department, but finding national standards and then starting from there. And certainly, as Jamie said, it varies. Fortunately, the AAAP at least has regional differences. In Seattle, the cost of housing is very high, even though sometimes the salaries are lower than the Eastern salaries. I tried to have everyone within a certain division, say it was endocrinology or general pediatrics or emergency room, be equitable within that division. The national standards don't necessarily reflect current competitive salaries. And so when you bring someone in and to someone that requires a salary that's high, in say the 70th percentile, that creates a lot of inequity sometimes in the division. And I had departmental policies and standards that we would do our best to raise the salaries of the other people when that came in. Jamie brought up a point that I learned early on, and that was, say you have an emergency room physician and they're a residency director. Oh, well, that residency director time should be compensated like the other residency directors. And I did that 1 year and about lost half the emergency department. So I gave up that fight. It doesn't make sense that you have different duties and you pay them all the same. That was a losing battle for me, and I never was able to change that. I tried to look at salaries in a division, not just as an individual, so that if you had bonuses or that they reflected how the people's contribution to the overall division goal. So it wasn't necessarily just based on research, if it was research, or just based on clinical, so that everyone benefited by supporting each other. And that worked in the department. It was harder selling that to the institution, who was very interested in tying the compensation to the effort rather than the divisional goal.
That's a really, really good observation, Bruder. One of the issues that I think would be interesting to talk about in regards to academic funds flow and faculty compensation is how much background we feel an upcoming pediatric leader should have in finance in order to take a position as, say, a division chief or a department chair or a vice dean or a dean. How much financial background do Jamie, have you found is important to take that position?
I think at least an introductory knowledge of concepts like what's a profit and loss statement or an income statement look like, and what is it telling me? Why is it important to pay attention to the balance sheet and the cash that we have on hand, and what does day's cash mean, and how much should I have? Typically, for new chairs that are a bit early in their career, we'll do kind of a finance 101 training with them to walk through those things, because ultimately a new leader or a new chair typically will have a finance lead or an administrative lead to help them with that, but they definitely need to understand the concepts and be able to identify problems. Certainly, knowledge or familiarity with compensation plans and designing and implementing and tracking and administering them. There's a lot of time spent on that. And then the last concept financially, I would say, is important is the notion of encumbrances and commitments and how you book and track and follow through on those. Because typically, departments and certainly schools of medicine carry a long list of commitments that span years, if not
Yeah.
decades.
I agree with Jamie's comments completely. There is some fundamental level understanding that I think is important for a new leader coming into a role to have. But to the point Jamie alluded to, I think the relationship with the administrator, whether it's a division business manager, a business administrator, a department associate dean of finance and administration in the dean's office in a role similar to Jamie's, those partnerships and relationships are critical, particularly for new leaders to really help them get up to speed. And so while the introductory courses, that the dean's office offers and things like that are good to learn about your institution, I think to understand the relationship with the administrator is incredibly valuable and should be something that's relied upon pretty regularly by a leader to help navigate and make sure their understanding of the environment that they're in is accurate. I think that collective wisdom is helpful.
I actually did my MBA more than 30 years ago, not because of a leadership position, but because I was involved in startups that had spun out from my research. And then I did take a leadership position as department chair a decade later. I found that the MBA was sort of a mixed blessing. It certainly helped me to speak the language, to understand very quickly what was happening. But it didn't necessarily mean that I would be listened to. I was quickly put on the finance committee of our practice plan. We were given the directive that we were going to use MGMA and that we were going to level the field so that all departments would be seen the same way. And as you know, pediatricians are already undervalued and underpaid. And it made things difficult. We lost some faculty because of this and then tried to rebalance and eventually scrap the notion of a one-size-fits-all practice plan, but it was a difficult time trying to raise some of these issues from a perspective of somebody who's run a business, who had an MBA, and being told that medicine is different.
Thanks, Bruce. Going back to this issue of the MBA, I didn't have an MBA. I did go to the Harvard course and found it extremely useful after I'd had a year or two learning the ropes and having a great CPA administrator who mentored me. It was very helpful having some experience as a chair and having someone you could rely on to keep you out of trouble and help you learn the ropes and then really understand what you needed. And it really helped me. I also think that it depends on what your leadership goals are in terms of why you're getting the MBA. I had a young neonatologist that I was trying to recruit. He, in talking to him about his package, he said, "Would I support him getting an MBA?" And I said, then I opened the discussion, what are your goals? And he said, "Well, I want to be a department chair." And I said, "Well, an academic department chair?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, an MBA might would be maybe helpful down the road, but if you want to be a chair, you have to develop a career as an academician before." So, I mean, I think it depends on your career goals. If you want to be your long-term goal is to be a hospital administrator, or then it could be very helpful early on. But I think sometimes it's thought that the MBA is a substitute for an academic portfolio. I think that would be a mistake if you're looking for real leaders to develop. You're looking for someone who has leadership skills and who has the golden drive to be excellent in that. And if eventually getting an MBA is what would help that person, then that's a different story than, well, I'm going to get an MBA because that's going to be a portfolio builder for me to be a chief.
I think one of the hard things to understand about leadership, when you're starting in your various leadership roles during your career, is that you're put in that position usually not because someone thought that you had all the right answers to any question that might come up. You're put in that position because someone thought that you had the ability to work with other people to come up with an answer that really makes a lot of sense and that they can
Right.
respond.
That's exactly right.
And it's actually true with finance too. I mean, I think it's more important than the knowledge you have as you look at that position and say, I want to have it, is your ability to be inquisitive and to take that sort of ability to understand you don't know everything, or sometimes not even very much, but to find mentors, to find people that you can work with to learn those things that you need to be successful in your position. I think it's also really important when you take a new job as a division chief or a chair to understand what number you're going to be held accountable for. What are the, at the various timelines, what is it that people want to see? Is it going to be your overall profit loss statement as a department? Is it going to be, there's just a lot of things that you might be held responsible for, and you really need to try and understand what those responsibilities are. But I really think the most important thing is that you maintain an openness, an inquisitiveness, and an ability to learn and to take mentorship and realize that you don't really know the answers to everything. I do think, and I'd be interested to hear what other people have to say about this. I do think an MBA can be helpful for physicians early in their career, especially if they indeed becoming more administrative as they get older and get more experience. I don't think it's essential at this point. I think 20 years ago when I started in the game, I don't think it was essential at all. I think it's becoming more important now. I would suggest that people think about getting some learning. I mean, to understand what a balance sheet is and how it relates to profit loss is probably not important that you absolutely have that when you start, but you need to have the ability to understand how to compare those two things over time. And as you rise in administrative responsibilities, it becomes even more important. So I'd be interested
Right.
in what other people have to say about that.
Yeah, maybe I'll jump in a couple of points. One is the methodology that I was blanking on is the CARTS methodology, which is pretty straightforward. It's already a number of things that Jamie pointed to, which is clinical, administrative, research, teaching, and strategic, which was referred to. But the other is really understanding how to, if you're a children's hospital within a larger hospital system, having a business plan and knowing what a business plan is to seek the resources for your department is really critical, and how you arrive at that. And for me, when I was in that role, it was really having a very strong administrator who helped with the financing and also could do the educational piece for the faculty. And we did use a consultant to actually go deep into the weeds for each of the divisions. So there was ownership by the division directors that this was their division. And, similar to what Brutus said, is that you want equity within a division, but you also want to leverage the relationship with the broader administration in addressing key issues such as gender equity and analyses that may need some analysis external sort of support.
One comment and one question. The importance of being able to communicate and educate faculty. So, if you're a division chief or a department chair, being fluent enough in these concepts to be able to explain it to faculty is really important. I will share a humorous story, though. One time, several years ago, we were accused of being too opaque about finances. And so, we made a concerted effort to be more specific about it. And then the comment was, the department chief seems to only care about finances. So striking that balance is important. I did have one question. I don't know if this is taking us down a tangent that we don't want to pursue at this point, but I wondered about people's thoughts regarding incentives and that aspect of compensation. What's a fair percentage of one's overall compensation that is productivity derived or related to quality and safety goals or related to scholarship, and just wondered what people's thoughts were there.
Incentives. And it's almost a point that should have a discussion by itself, because I think different types of specialties, different levels of compensation, incentives mean different things to different people, and how one goes about doing that. I think one of the things that obviously underlies it is you want to be considered fair overall. I do think that sometime in the past, there was not nearly as much transparency among total compensation packages as there is now. At least as I advanced in my career, I found that people were less and less able to feel that their salary was not known by other people. And that can be a problem if you develop a lot of disparities in overall compensation package.
Thinking in terms of where we were talking first about incentives and where academic promotion comes into that picture. So, someone who is academically quite productive and is getting promoted. I remember when I got promoted at Columbia to associate, I got $5,000 more. And it was like, so how do we value? And this is the CARTS methodology was meant to kind of take a look at the varying contributions to the division, to the department, and to the institution as a whole. And the burdens of that are very different if you're very involved in faculty practice, and you're heading down that administrative role with an MBA, et cetera, and if you have an academic career. So I think it's complicated in terms of how you provide that balance, the incentive, what your vision is for your division or your department, and where you sit in the larger institutional sort of motivation. So I think it's a tough topic, but the issue of making people feel that they're valued, that their work is recognized, there are different ways to do that as well.
That's a really good point. I think that though one of the things about mentoring, and I think Bruder pointed on this, and I think Danielle's comments do too, is a good mentor knows not only what tools might be available, but when it's appropriate in someone's career to really encourage them to take those opportunities to learn those tools. John, I'd be really interested as, from your career, you've had opportunities to look at it from sort of both sides. How the financial interrelationships between the medical school and the hospital administration and maybe the faculty group practice, how all those play out in terms of this funds flow question.
Well, it's a great point, Craig. And I think what's important is that they have alignment amongst the three. A lot of times the practice plan is a part of the School of Medicine. Sometimes it's independent from the School of Medicine, but that's where an understanding of your local environment is really important. I think the hospital understanding that the fees and the revenue that is flowing into the hospital is significant. And so more times than not, the hospital is participating on the funding of whatever it is. If it's a clinical program expansion, if it's an overall compensation adjustment for all faculty, even if it's education or if it's research related, that's going to attract another clinical provider or clinical expert into the group. The hospital is usually a part of that. And I think understanding the interrelationship between those three is vitally important. But I always come back to that alignment because I think that's what's critical is are the three aligned in what they're doing? And that's where I think a regular routine strategic planning process is very important. It's not unusual to have a department administrator or a service chief come to the hospital and say, "Hey, I've got this great idea," or "I've got this person." Jamie's laughing because he knows it happens to him all the time that people contact him about stuff. That's right. But again, that comes back to the alignment. And not that really unique special opportunities won't arise because they do. And that's one of the things that I always said is you've got to be nimble enough that you can pivot to an outstanding opportunity that presents itself that you weren't expecting, particularly in this day and age where there is just a lack of really good talent out there. If that knocks on your door, you've got to be ready to pivot. But as a hospital administrator, it's a quick call over to my colleague in the College of Medicine, maybe someone like Jamie, to say, "Hey, this opportunity is here. What do you think about this?" Because we need to stay in alignment. The relationship and the funds flow are decided at a very high level, at the board level. And so you've got to make sure that if there's a pivot to that there is alignment there. So I think that's what's very important in the relationship between the School of Medicine, the hospitals, and the practice plan.
Absolutely, John. I think that the three-legged stool is none of us has a one-legged stool. And the successful leaders are those who are able to sort of present those things that are important, they feel, for their success and make it so and understand how that it contributes to the success of the other legs of that stool.
I was thinking the same thing, Craig. I mean, one of the worst things I think a leader can do is to get themselves in a contentious situation where you're arguing about money with the health system, the group practice, or the school instead of focusing on the mission. If you've got a true partnership. I think the leaders understand the value that's brought through all of the various missions. Residents are a pipeline for faculty recruitment and staff in the hospital. Research leads to new treatments and innovations and draws patients to the health system that would go there versus other places that don't offer the same sorts of things. And obviously, clinical taking care of patients is key to what we do. But a partnership between the kind of three legs of the stool is really important.
I would add to what you said, Jamie. I think that, our commitment to education, to research, but also to the community is vitally important in setting that alignment so that you look at the population that you're serving and are you adequately serving that population and what are the key issues, health issues that your community is addressing. So I think that alignment, and you mentioned mission driven, sometimes we're criticized to be mission driven. Well, that's our job. We're supposed to do that. And then we need to balance the budget and we need to be financially the stewardship, the financial stewardship is really important. But if we forget the mission, that's no good, right? And I think Bruder was pointing that out in terms of, if you have an MBA, but you don't have an academic career or you don't know where you're going, that MBA is not going to be helpful. But it's a tool like anything else.
Well, I think we've actually covered a lot of really interesting points today. I want to take a minute out to thank Jamie so much for taking time out of his schedule and helping us put together an amazingly productive discussion on how academic funds flow and faculty compensation play a role in pediatric leadership. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30 plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com.